Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Book Chat. I'm Bobby Palmer, she's Pandora Sykes.
Hello, it is she.
And every episode, we each bring a book to chat about. And if you're new here, there is only one rule. The books have to be more than 2 years old. First up, we have to discuss the fact that Armistead Maupin, Book Chat alumnus from our very first episode, has just announced another Tales of the City book, which will be his 10th. The plot is about Mona running a B&B in an English country manor, so it's as wacky as I think we'd expect.
Wonder why he decided to do another one now. Wonder if he'll end at 10. Nice round number.
This is also our 10th episode. It sounded like you already knew that with that lovely lead in, Pandora. Did you know?
I did not. I didn't actually tee you up. Thank God for you. You are the organisation behind this operation.
And you are too kind. Google tells me that the 10th anniversary is the Tin anniversary. And speaking of our very first episode, we also read Tin Man by Sarah Winman. So, you know, not to get all metaphysical, but things really are coming full circle.
I think you can find a link. If you really want to find a link, I think you can always find one.
Pandora, what are you reading right now?
Well, I just read First Love by Gwendolyn Riley. Did you ever read that?
No, I did hear good things about My Phantoms.
Oh, I haven't read that one. This one I came across, I think someone posted an Instagram story, very good cover, came out in 2017, and I think it was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. It is quite a short book about a toxic relationship, and it's very, I'm trying to think of like the best, but it's, I think someone put it well when they said it was like the most perfect horrid book. It is horrid. It's really well written, but it's horrid.
That sounds like Fever Dream, which we've discussed before. Fever Dream by Samantha Schweblin. That is the perfect. That's very
is
short.
That horrid?
And it's a horrid little book.
What are you reading right now? Any horrid little books?
No, I'm reading a not horrid long book. But I say reading. We've never talked about audiobooks on this podcast. I'm a big audiobook guy. I'm also a big believer that it does count as reading.
This is very controversial, this topic, isn't it? I think they are different ways of reading, but I don't think one's better than the other. That's my diplomatic answer.
That's a good diplomatic answer. Do you listen to audiobooks?
I have, in my whole adult life, listened to half of one. Empire of Pain, that's it.
Weirdly, I have also listened to Empire of Pain on audio. I loved it because I love it when a journalist reads out their own work and they sort of know when to bring all the drama.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're not an audible girl.
My brain just wanders too easily. It's why I don't actually listen to podcasts, really, unless I'm driving.
So weirdly, my taste in audiobooks is like the total opposite of my taste in physical books. So as you well know, I prefer my books to be weird and metaphorical, often quite short. But with audiobooks, I like them very factual. I like them often historical, and I definitely like them to be very, very long, because I like something that can keep me gripped when I'm driving, or when I walk the dog, or when I'm cooking. All that is a very long-winded way of saying that I've just started the 30-hour-long version of the Wolf Hall trilogy by Hilary Mantel.
God, who narrates that?
It's Dan Stevens, actually, and he does it really well. He does it really well, apart from the fact that his Henry VIII sounds a bit like Matt Berry, so he sort of comes into a room and is like, "Hello, everyone in the court!" I really went for it.
You did. I think that's the most vital you've been on this podcast. That length, though, reminds me of when I did try and be an audible girl and I downloaded A Brief History of Everything, whatever it's called, with my first free audible credit. And when it downloaded, I saw that it was 19 hours and I never even opened it.
I did do the Peter Capaldi version of Watership Down last Christmas, and that was 17 hours.
Oh.
This Wolf Hall one is a new frontier, and I think it's sort of just gearing me up for my audiobook white whale, which is the 60-hour version of War and Peace, in which Tandiwe Newton plays every single character.
Sorry, what? She recorded 60 hours of audio herself?
Yes, she did, and thankfully not in a Russian accent.
When was this?
It was only 2 years ago. It was quite a big release at the time. You know, it's big in every manner.
Flipping heck. That is a white whale indeed. This is your necessary spoiler warning, but we're actually thinking of doing less spoilers going forward. Bobby, Inbox King, did we have any feedback on whether that was preferred?
Consensus seems to be less spoilers.
Noted.
Also, we should do a little content warning, though we won't be going into too much detail. In our conversation around The Bluest Eye, we will be talking a bit about sexual abuse, so if you want to avoid that bit, it's second up, so you can just dip out during the ad break in the middle. So, Pandora, you go first. What's your book this month?
Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, by Judy Blume.
Speaking of vital, that was nice. Bravo. A bona fide, much-loved classic, right? Give me the lowdown.
Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was written in 1970 by the quote-unquote poet laureate. How do you say that?
Laureate. Yeah.
Such a weird word. By the poet laureate of puberty, as The Atlantic so brilliantly dubbed her, Judy Blume. Now, I imagine many of our female listeners are getting a veritable bloom in their heart at the mention of her name, because she was such a stalwart for the millennial preteen slash teen. The novelist Emily Barr pointed out that at the time of reading this, lots of girls like me were reading or just sort of graduating out of Enid Blyton, and Daryl Rivers and the rest of the Mallory Towers girls never got periods. So Judy Blume was a real educator in every sense, but in this really light way. I think I read someone say, you know, she's never preachy, and I agree with that. I'm sure many of you listening are also haunted by Ralph.
Do I want to know who Ralph is?
Ralph was the name a boy called Michael gave his penis in Judy Blume's book Forever, which is about a girl and a boy losing their virginity. Yeah, I haven't got anything to say back to that, yeah. I can remember where I was when I was reading that and everything, and I have to say, Ralph still makes me slightly recoil. Anyway, Judy Blume, now 85, has sold over 90 million books. Do you think that's one of the most selling in the world?
It's
must be up there
up
with
there.
Who else would be?
Dan Brown.
J.K. Rowling's obviously going to be really big. Dan Brown, J.K. Rowling.
The Bible.
Snore the Bible. Not snore the Bible, but like snore to you for suggesting the Bible. Anyway, this is a whole other podcast, but I'm interested to know who are the top 10. But Bobby, was she remotely seminal for the male teenager? Had you ever read any of her? I presume you've heard of her?
Yes, I've heard of her. No, I've never read her. I have heard of the book. It definitely was not on the required reading list for a teenage boy.
What was on the required teenage list? Adrian Moll. Adrian Moll.
I've read a lot of Stephen King as a teenager, which is quite weird in hindsight.
Oh my God, Carrie.
Yeah, The Shining and stuff like that. So I think, if you know, if I'm ever like creepy and lurking in the shadows, that's why. I don't think there is really a male equivalent to this book. I find it interesting as well that she was massive over here, because I've always thought of her and of this book as an American phenomenon, and maybe thought that our version of this would be like Tracy Beaker or something like that.
Yeah, I think Jacqueline Wilson was bigger when I was younger. I think probably the male equivalents skew older, so Adrian Moll and Catcher in the Rye. I think it's that kind of age-old thing of, oh, nothing to talk about for boys. Boys are fine. They'll just punch each other and, you know, yeah. on they
yes,
go.
They do.
Although Judy Blume did actually write a version of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Not exactly the same, but sort of what she saw as the companion piece for boys. Can't remember what it's called, which suggests that, yeah, it wasn't nearly so popular. This was the most popular of her books. So it's about Margaret, an almost 12-year-old girl who moves from New York to New Jersey with her mother and her father. And she joins a girl gang at her new school called the Preteen Sensations. Love that, the PTSs. And she talks to a non-secular god about how much she wants her period and to have boobs. It's a very charming, gentle book, and it's still censored in some states, if you can believe it.
I genuinely cannot believe that.
So Judy Blume said at the time her own kids' school banned it because it talked about menstruation. And a school in Florida even removed it from their library this year. Flipping Ron DeSantis. It's ridiculous.
That is really interesting and really surprising because it means both the books we're talking about today are American books, which have been and still are banned all across America. Because nothing screams freedom like banning books.
Yeah, freedom of speech, all about banning books, about periods. Was it weird for you reading a book about a preteen who wants her period? I was trying to wonder what it was like from a admittedly very progressive adult male perspective.
Thank you for clarifying that I am progressive. It was illuminating and funny and sweet. I think, I imagine the reception from a man even like 15, 20 years ago would be quite different because I think people talk about this stuff a lot more now. It's a lot more out in the open.
Yeah.
As much as I say all that, I definitely didn't feel like I, a 30-something British man, was quite the intended audience. A lot of it went over my head. I couldn't really identify with the emotions. You know, I've never had my first bra fitted, for example.
I never had my first bra fitted.
Oh, fair enough. Well, we're similar then. And nothing really happens in the book. You know, I'm not going to sit here slating a book which is written for 12-year-old girls because that'd be like me bullying a bunch of schoolgirls. But I really appreciated it as a book that is not written for me.
Yeah, it's a really cute book. It's a solid YA book. I skipped through it. And the tone is set, I think, from the first page. We moved on the Tuesday before Labor Day. I knew what the weather was like the second I got up. I knew because I caught my mother sniffing under her arms. She always does that when it's hot and humid to make sure her deodorant's working. I don't use deodorant yet. I don't think people start to smell bad until they're at least 12. So I've still got a few months to go. And to be honest, that kind of confessional candid tone, I think, has been really influential in like YA content generally, not just literature. Because if you watch all those kind of shows like Never Have I Ever and The Summer I Turned Pretty and all, or the Flying Underpants or whatever that one was called, basically that kind of whole idea of a teenager talking, I mean, Margaret's talking to God, but kind of talking to the screen or writing in their diary, that's a really familiar tone, I think, now.
Yeah, you could almost imagine it as like a voiceover on a Netflix show. Although, of course, God nowadays to teenagers is TikTok. Anyway, I loved how they call themselves the preteen sensations or the PTSs.
Me too.
I thought it was, every time they said that word, it made me smile.
I love how much Playboy was clearly an open thing in the 70s. Margaret talks about how her dad gets Playboy. To me, that would be seriously gross, finding my dad's dirty magazines, but it sounds very accepted then. So I can only imagine that Playboy was much less graphic.
This was the 70s, Pandora. It was a freer time. Lots of hairy chests and avocado bathrooms, or they're probably less hairy chests in Playboy, actually. The book doesn't feel very 70s, though, which I think surprised me. I expected it to feel like a...
No.
Not like a historical book, because it's not that long ago, but I expected it to feel like a period piece, and it isn't. And I think that's probably why it's still so celebrated. I'd love to know if teenage girls read it to the same extent now. The cover of my edition is laid out like a text conversation with, "Are you there, God? Blank, it's me, Margaret," in two speech bubbles, as if she's sort of texting God, which is a bit weird, but clearly an attempt to make it appeal to those hip young audiences. I'm making myself sound so old.
I think because, so I've had a look. I was just having a look inside when you were saying that. So the thing that really dates this is that she has her hair done in like big rollers and she has a cream rinse and she talks about wearing her velvet, which is nylon.
See, these are all things that would have just flown totally over my head. I was just like, that's what girls do.
But there's nothing about what they ate. There's no like, and then we had pineapple on sticks, and there's nothing about what films they read, what books they read. It's very, very like myopic. It's literally just Margaret. Margaret really wants her period. It's still so true of teenage girlhood. Margaret speaks to Nancy every night on the phone and her dad is like, how can you have stuff to talk to her about when you're at school together all day? And I just thought, teenage girls. I could still do that, to be honest, if I had the time. Some of it does feel out of date tonally, like when Gretchen's mum tells her that now she has got her period, she has to be careful what she eats because she's gained a lot of weight that summer. but it's very in keeping with that whole Jane Fonda cardio Weight Watchers cottage cheese time, 1970. Also, this broke my... Actually, I don't know if Weight Watchers was out in 1970. TBD. And also, this broke my heart. The slut shaming of a girl named Laura Danker, who all the preteen sensations assume is a slut because she developed boobs at a young age. And that totally, totally happened when I was younger. Girls who were more developed were definitely assumed to be more sexual. And that's horrendous. I really, really hope that's not the case anymore. I'm not sure. I'd have to canvas to find out.
You know, you notice there's a Nancy Wheeler. Do you watch Stranger Things? One of the main characters is called Nancy Wheeler. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did try to Google it, and apparently it's I guess, a coincidence, maybe. Yeah, the Laura Danker stuff I found quite moving, and I think it is intentional because they're very... I think Margaret becomes very aware of the fact that they've been unfairly bullying her, I guess, for the fact that she's gone through puberty early and that she's tall and that she's got boobs. And there's this quite touching scene later on where Laura Danker confronts her, and her what Margaret thought was the case isn't the case, and you actually feel really sorry for Laura, and Margaret feels really embarrassed. And I think it was quite moving.
She's not hugely compassionate though, is she, Margaret?
No, she sort of then goes like, I'm gonna carry on with my life and not give a shit. But
and then when Nancy lies about getting her period, she's like, oh, don't worry, I guess she must really want it. And then she's like, I'm never trusting her again.
Nancy sucks though. Nancy isn't great. I mean, yeah. I'm just saying that about like an 11-year-old girl, but I wouldn't be friends with her.
She's much greater in the film, actually. She's played really well in the film. It is really funny, though. I totally give it to my daughter to read. And as I said, it has just been turned into a film starring Rachel McAdam as Margaret's mum and Kathy Bates as her grandmother, who's amazing, as her kind of very sort of claustrophobic grandmother. They basically moved to New Jersey to escape her grandmother. The film sticks pretty closely to the book's plot, even dialogue. But what really interested me, it's fine, it's sweet, the film, but it really interested me that it focuses a lot more on Margaret's mum than the book does. In the book, she's barely sketched out as a character. In the film, she's a woman reconnecting with her artist self. She's a woman estranged from her anti-Semitic parents. Like, that's really quite heartbreaking, that stuff. She's a woman still hot for her husband. There's this sort of slightly weird, saucy bit when Margaret's dad cuts himself on the lawnmower. And it's lovely, but it does sort of do the book a bit of a disservice because it's not meant to be about the parents at all. This is a book seen totally through Margaret's eyes because she is a myopic preteen girl, and it's literally just about her and her budding chest.
Yeah, it's not called Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret's Mum, is it, Pandora?
No, it's not called that.
The book actually reminded me of another film called Eighth Grade, which is this...
Oh, yeah.
It's such a brilliant depiction of a young teenage girl. It's like heartwarming but also excruciating. It's a more modern film, so she has the same like awkward birthday party invites and stuff, but she also does like YouTube videos that no one watches, and I'm squirming just thinking about it, but it's so sweet.
Is that Olivia Wilde's film? Is that her first
No,
film?
That's Booksmart, which is great.
I've seen Booksmart.
Bo Burnham directed it. And they came out at really similar times, and they're sort of tonally similar, but Eighth Grade is way more cringe. One thing I'm interested about in the book, important question, the girls do this exercise to try and make their boobs grow where they extend their arms and they chant, we must, we must, we must increase our bust. Is that a real thing that girls do as teenagers?
Yeah, definitely, definitely did it when we were younger. I think probably before teenagers. I think Judy Blume invented that ditty. The internet suggests that she invented that rhyme, which is, I mean, I'd have that on my gravestone.
That's like the biggest achievement, you know, 90 million copies is nothing compared to that. I really felt like I feel like I am still learning so much, and I learned so much from this book.
And just in time for having a daughter of your own.
God help me, as Margaret would say. What's your favourite bit?
The private lady company made me laugh. Margaret hates being sold to, so she refuses to buy sanitary towels by the company that's been paid to come in and teach them about their periods, the private lady company. And instead, she opts for teenage Softies. I do love all the brand names. That feels very suburban America at a very specific time. Like, you know, and they had stuff like Cheez-Its and or whatever they were called. The Grow Bra without a W, for example. That's much more common in the UK now, but it used to be such an American thing in the late... Up until the late 90s, I'd say that the kind of early noughties is when we started getting much more Americanized, like linguistically and culturally. But back then, this was just very much an American thing, and I enjoyed that.
Private Lady is so great. That sounds like something from an Armistead Maupin book. Yes. Speaking about, you know, American suburbia and the time, I was actually surprised how religious this book is. And I think reading it as a Brit, I feel like the UK is a much more secular society than the US. So I found it, for all its progressiveness and its positive sexuality, it was quite traditional in its approach to religion, in whether Margaret wants to be Christian or Jewish, and that all of her little addresses to God, I expected them to be funnier, but they're actually quite sincere and pious. They're all about like finding, you know, some of them are about growing her boobs or getting her period, but a lot of them are about like finding faith and going to church and what God she should believe in.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wonder if it's because the UK is more secular, if that's because in America at that time was going through something of a change.
I think it's probably a combination of the two, but I'd be interested if it reads that way. You know, if Americans would pick up on that, or if it would feel more normal, I guess. Would you have changed anything about this book?
No, it's really cute. Philip Leroy is a bit of a jerk. Maybe he should get some comeuppance.
He's no Moose Freed, is he?
Moose Freed sounds like someone out of Close Range.
Yeah, he really. There is nothing more middle American than fancying the boy who mows your lawn.
Yes.
And the boy who mows your lawn being called Moose Freed. Do you think this book's classic Judy Blume?
I'd have to reread Forever and Deanie, which is another famous one by her about a dancer who gets scoliosis and has to wear a brace. But off the top of my head, absolutely. And as I said earlier, she did write a teenage coming of age one, or a preteen coming of age one for boys too. But yeah, haven't read that one.
I should read that one. It might tell me why my voice has dropped. will you... It's a bit of a weird question, actually. Will you be reading more Judy Blume? I feel like, you know, we've both sort of passed the
age, the demographic.
The Judy Blume, yeah, the Judy Blume apex. But will you be reading more?
I think I'll probably wait till my daughter hits 9 or 10 and then we can read them again together. I feel like you won't be reading more.
Not in a rush, but yeah, that is a lovely idea, you know, about reading with your daughter. And I don't want to be the sort of a squeamish dad, so it's good to get a head start on this stuff, and I'd like to read books like this with my daughter too, although my daughter no doubt will find that absolutely horrifying as an idea, so that's probably a job for mum.
I'd love to visit Judy Blume's store Books and Books in Key West, like Ann Patchett. She actually works in the store despite being 85.
Books and Books might have been a better name for this podcast
newsletter.
Your newsletter, you should have named it something different. No, it would have been a better name for the book and book would be a good name for this podcast, because we each bring a book. Anyway, very cool to be an author and own a bookshop, something to aspire to, although mine will probably be somewhere much less glamorous than Key West.
I can so see you having a bookshop. I can actually visualise you in 30 years extremely clearly, Bobby.
Don't know how to take that because I can't see the visual. I hope it's a nice one.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Bobby, tell me about your book.
So my choice today is another seminal book from the exact same year, 1970, and that is The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. Pandora, have you read any Toni Morrison before?
I've read Beloved, and that's it. I really don't know why I haven't read any other Toni Morrison. It's shameful, actually. I can't understand why none of it was on my GCSE, A-level, or undergraduate syllabus. That's also shameful.
Well, even more shameful is the fact that I've never read any Toni Morrison, and this book was my first. I chose it because I have always wanted to read her. And though I think the more natural starting point would have been Beloved, because it's, you know, it's her most famous one, and because on the surface it's probably a bit more me, there's a ghost in it, this felt like such a good comparison to Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, that we couldn't pass it up. So even though this book isn't set at the time, it's another, you know, book in the 1970s. It's about a girl on the cusp of puberty. It's got those parallels, but they just couldn't be more different.
I agree. It was really surprising to be reading them in conjunction to one another, because aside from the fact that they were both published in 1970 by very famous authors, I really didn't think we'd been finding any parallels. And both have that real hook of being about menstruation. And in one book, it's this massive disaster and inconvenience. And in another book, you know, in a sort of cosseted 70s privileged white middle America, it's something to yearn for. And I mean, period poverty is a real thing for a young woman in Depression era America, and still now. And of course, it plays a vital role in this book because, as we learn on the very first page, Pekala, the 12-year-old protagonist, is carrying her father's child.
Yeah, and I think that's an insight into, you know, just how different this book is. The Bluest Eye is Toni Morrison's first novel. It takes place in Lorain, Ohio. It's set in the 1940s, and it's a book about beauty and racism and how they intersect and how that same racism ruins families and communities and trickles down from generation to generation. Morrison said she also wrote it as a response to other black literature at the time, which was very revolutionary, aggressively positive, mostly written by men with slogans like "Black is beautiful." This novel explores the flip side of that, which is how black women are made to feel ugly. And that manifests in the main character, Pekala, who wants nothing more than blue eyes like a white child. And that's where the title comes from. So Pekala lives in poverty. She's teased, she's bullied, she's beaten down, even by some of the girls who are supposedly her friends, like Claudia and Frida, who are kind. If there's a point of view of the book, it's them. Pekala's parents don't have it any easier. Her mother, Pauline, is a servant for a wealthy white family and kind of gives over her whole being to that. And then Pekala's father, Cholly, is an abusive, violent alcoholic who we also find out has been hugely mistreated by white people in his past. From that first page, you know where it's going, but he takes that out on Pekala in the most horrible possible way. The book is really dark, and it is often a really tough read, but it never feels gratuitous, and I think that is quite an impressive feat.
So in my copy, both the foreword and the afterword share some of the same paragraphs. They've sort of been like, this has been slightly plagiarised, but she says basically that the origin of this story lies in a conversation she had with a childhood friend who they just started school, and the friend said that she wanted blue eyes. And Toni Morrison says she pretended to be sympathetic, but inside she was absolutely furious. She said, who made her feel that it was better to be a freak, so a girl with very dark skin and blue eyes, than what she was? Who had looked at her and found her so wanting, so small a weight on the beauty scale? And she says, this novel pecks away at the gaze that condemned her. It's a reclamation of racial beauty, she says. It stirred her thoughts and made her think about the necessity for the claim. Anyway, the afterward and the forward are actually like incredibly interesting. I'd really, really suggest, well, reading them both. I also think that this is a book about senses. There is so much about what things taste like, what they feel like. It's a book about really seeing and feeling the world for what it is. You know, so very near the beginning, Mr. Henry arrives on a Saturday night. We smelled him. He smelled wonderful, like trees and lemon vanishing cream and new Nile hair oil and flecks of sensen. You know, that's established really near the beginning. We're always told what people smell like. And there's this great bit where Claudia speaks about what she wants for Christmas. And everyone assumes that she wants a thing. And actually, she says she wants an experience. She wants to sit on the low stool in Big Mama's kitchen with her lap full of lilacs, listening to her father play his violin for the first time. And she said, and since it would be good to have all of my senses engaged, the taste of a peach, perhaps, afterwards.
I think that sensual description is very, it makes it very believable that this is a book from the point of view of children. And I think in different ways, both this and the Judy Blume book really feel like kids telling you the way they see the world. As I said earlier, another similarity between these two books is they've both been banned. And this book has been banned time and time and time again in the last 50 years. from high schools, from libraries all across America. The most often reason cited is, you know, fairly obviously the graphic sexual content, but also, and I quote, an underlying socialist communist agenda. Did you find that this book had an underlying socialist communist agenda, Pandora? Me too. The funny thing is, before I read this book, and it's a book that comes with a lot of baggage because it's such a phenomenon, I'd been told that this was a grim book. You know, this was a book that would make me feel sad, and I kind of knew what it was about before I started reading it, and I expected to dislike it for that reason, because I really don't like what would now be described as misery porn, and I'm not naming any particular books, but you can probably guess a couple of the ones I'm talking about.
A Little Life.
I didn't say it. But this is not that. This is a sad book and a dark book, but it's also an incredible, beautiful, powerful, and really affecting book.
I think I can't not see it in the context of her own nonfiction writing in the afterword, in the foreword, in what she's written about it, in the interviews she's given where there's something incredibly charismatic about the way she talks. She's so considered. She's got this like incredibly thoughtful, sort of gentle but powerful voice. Anyway, I can't really put it into... I can only see it in the context of like everything about Toni Morrison. I was noodling around the internet looking for interviews she'd done about the book, and I found a couple of really good filmed ones. And there's one from 1976 where she writes that she wrote the book for people like her.
But I knew that I wanted to read about people like me. People who were Black and were young and had lived in the Midwest. And nobody wrote about them. And whenever they did, they were never center stage in a text. They were always toys, background, scenery.
It took her 5 years to write The Bluest Eye, she said, and she started it when she was really lonely. She was 30, she just moved, she had young children, and she was newly divorced. It reflected, she said, the emotional chaos of that time.
I think that really comes across. It is a really emotional work of art. It feels like she poured a lot into it.
Yeah, well, she says that she's not a novelist, she's a writer. She says a novelist, their job is to write books. I think of myself as a writer because I only write a book when I cannot not. I love her too on critical reviews.
I mean, there are books all over the world that I loathe, and I don't want anybody to tell me I can't loathe them, even if I admire some other works they do. That's not the point. The point is I like a little careful respect and thoughtfulness. I don't like a bad review that's badly written. Now that's insulting to me.
And insulted because it wasn't a careful consideration, didn't try hard enough to understand what you were trying to get at in this book.
It was like an 11th grade student who turns in a review of a book report, and says, I hated this book. It's not as good as something else. And what you do, if you're the 11th grade English teacher, you just give it back to them. And so you have to be better at explaining your reasons than this. That's what I thought about that.
I think you can definitely tell in this book that she was trying to do something new, something that hadn't been done before, because it's so formally inventive. When we discussed When I Hit You a few months back, we talked about how Mina Kandasamy cycles through a lot of different styles and genres to explore abuse. And this does the same with cycles of abuse and with the perpetuation of misery in a racist society. So you've got some chapters in the first person, some a whole narrative set in the past. They switch rapidly between voices. There's this amazing tract at the end, which is this imagined narrative between two versions of Pekala, all happening within her own head. And the entire book is framed quite famously by this extract from Dick and Jane, which is a American children's book about happy white children. That extract kicks off the whole novel. And this is just a little bit of it, just to give you an insight into the kind of thing it says. Here is the house. It is green and white. It has a red door. It is very pretty. Here is the family. Mother, father, Dick, and Jane live in the green and white house. They are very happy. See Jane. She has a red dress. She wants to play. Who will play with Jane? So that's just a kid's book. And I imagine a kid's book that was very familiar to a lot of people reading it at the time. But then the way she uses that extract, she fragments it throughout the whole book in these rapid fire, unnerving chapter headings without punctuation all in capitals. So, you know, one of the chapters, the chapter heading, and this is all in capitals, is sort of better if you see it written down, but "See Father, he is big and strong. Father, will you play with Jane? Father is smiling. Smile, Father, smile, smile." It's like really haunting, really quite creepy, and it creates this really powerful comparison between the two Americas, the suburban, idyllic, middle-class white America of Dick and Jane, or, you know, of "Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret?" And this America, the brutal, racist America in which these destitute black families live. And Toni Morrison actually said, I can't remember where I saw her say this, but the reason for the lack of punctuation and the sort of off-kilter version of that, her interpretation of Dick and Jane, is that you have like the classic Dick and Jane, which is the put-together white America, and then the fractured version, which is this black America. Morrison also said that she wrote this book essentially because young black girls were never written about, which I think is a sign of just how much it was doing something new at the time.
That is such useful context where you talk about Dick and Jane. I actually didn't know it was from Dick and Jane. I think this really suggests to me, so something that Zadie Smith said on Annie Max Changes podcast, you'll really enjoy that interview, by the way, Bobby, I think it came out last week, but she says how basically, why is it so weird to read a book twice? If you say to someone, read a book twice, they'd be like, what? Whereas, you know, you actually have to listen to a song loads of times sometimes to like it, to get what it's trying to do. And this is a book, I think, which I needed to read twice because I really didn't appreciate the simplicity, almost that sort of eerie formulaicness of Dick and Jane, that cohesive narrative where everything's really straightforward, and how that emphasizes this fractured narrative of these young black girls living in poverty. You know, I don't think I really appreciated it fully until stylistically. The story I fully appreciated, but stylistically, I think it needed another read. I mean, in her foreword, which reads quite like an academic tract, which would make sense, she was an academic and a professor as well as a writer, she says, "I focus therefore on how something as grotesque as the demonization of an entire race could take root inside the most delicate member of society, a child, the most vulnerable member, a female." So she is writing about young black girls, but she's actually sort of funneling a hell of a lot through Pecola. It's not just a story about young black girls. It's about a sort of a history of racism, if that doesn't sound too ambitious, but it is an ambitious book. To poodle back to what you just said, I couldn't agree more than with you that the subject matter is grim, grim, grim. But there is a levity in the book, not like Demon Copperhead because it's not as funny, but sort of like Demon Copperhead because it's super lyrical and it distills so much through its central characters. And it does read like poetry almost. Toni Morrison's won both a Pulitzer and the Nobel, the first African-American woman to win a Nobel for literature. And I am not surprised. And you know from the off that this is a really serious book. I mean, the first sort of italicized semi-opener said, "We thought at the time that it was because Pecola was having her father's baby that the marigolds did not grow." And you're like, oh my God, this is a serious book. And then you get another opener, which is just that beautifully written sentence. "Nuns go by as quiet as lust, and drunken men and sober eyes sing in the lobby of the Greek hotel." That could be a poem. But it is a serious book. It's beautiful and it isn't hard to read, but it's a very serious book on sentence level, subject matter, politics, all of it. And I can see how this changed literature. I can see how this influenced so much of what we read today. How many books probably wouldn't exist without it? Margaret Atwood, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Salman Rushdie have all said how she influenced them. Salman Rushdie's words on her I particularly loved. Toni Morrison led and we followed, and she showed us the beauty of language. So I can see how seminal it was, and I just feel so regretful that I didn't read this earlier. It's a staggering piece of work, and I actually felt reading it like I did reading August Town, that it condenses so much so beautifully.
It's really interesting you say that, because that specifically, that line about the nuns like lust and the sober eyes, and I underlined that, and I thought this could be a line from August Town. They both have that really amazing way of just having not having a spare word, but also having the occasional sentence of description where you just go, wow. You know, it sounds like that line about the guns in the bags that we talked about last time.
Yes. Just unfurls. Well, maybe she influenced him. I think there can be something quite trite about writing through the seasons, which is obviously the format of this book. You know, God bless Notting Hill, a film I love, with the sort of leaves turning brown and then walking into snow. But I think Morrison folds in the environment so well here because everything sort of influences and feeds into one another. You know, the abuse is part of the cold and the cold is part of the racism. And of course, she writes about the weather just as beautifully, describing the winter as a hateful knot that nothing could loosen. Obviously, the central act of violence is the part of the book that sticks out the most. It's the most known thing about the book. But what also really got me was when we see that Pauline looks after the white child in a way that she never has her own children, that the more she scrubbed that beautiful house and ironed the little girl's pink dress and cuddled her and soothed her, the more she let her own children go dirty and hungry and she beat them.
Yeah, there is such a beautiful bit of writing around that, where it says, more and more she neglected her house, her children, her man. They were like the afterthoughts one has just before sleep, the early morning and late evening edges of her day, the dark edges that made the daily life with the Fishers lighter, more delicate, more lovely. That's like exactly the sort of passage we were just talking about.
I mean, Morrison, I think there is really showing the secret life of servants, but it's more like, this is what it takes from a woman to give that much. This is the fallout from her servitude and her loyalty is her entire family. What was your favourite bit?
I think my favourite thing about it is that you can't really choose a favourite bit because, like you said, it reads like one long poem, all the parts. I feel like to extract one bit would take away from the whole. And I don't know why. I actually expected something really progressive, really brilliant and inventive in content, but fairly conventional in form before I started reading it. And it's the inventiveness of the book that's my favourite thing about it. The Dick and Jane stuff, the different voices, the way that every page it could just totally shift on its axis and change the way you're reading it. I really, really like it when a book does that.
One of the things I find most fascinating about this book, and she writes about it in her afterword, was how poorly received it was at the time. She writes, and this was written from Princeton, where she taught in 1993, with very few exceptions, the initial publication of The Bluest Eye was like Pecola's life, dismissed, trivialized, misread. And it has taken 25 years to gain for her the respectful publication this edition is.
Yeah, the response was very muted at the time. It sort of flew under the radar. And when it did get reviews, a lot of them were quite critical. I think maybe only as she published more books and became more of a phenomenon did it start to be appreciated in the way it deserves to be.
Part of what appears to be criticised is the form, so the thing that you love. Writing for the New York Times, Haskell Frankel argued that the novel's structure blunted the emotional impact of Pecola's mental breakdown. And Morrison herself later agreed with that, noting that her choice to, quote-unquote, break the narrative into parts that had to be reassembled by the reader seemed to me a good idea, but the execution of which does not satisfy me now. Besides, it didn't work. Many readers remained touched, but not moved. What's the difference between being touched and moved?
I don't know. I would say I was moved. I don't want to disagree with Toni Morrison. She's going to win an argument about her own book. But I love the form of it. I love the style of it and the way it breaks itself apart. I think that's my favourite thing about it.
Haskell Frankel, fun name that, also says that Pecola plays a secondary role in her sort of her own mistreatment until she zoomed in on quickly near the end. And that I do agree with. It doesn't really feel like her book, does it? Even though it's about The Bluest Eye, which is something she says, it starts with her, it ends with her. But we don't really learn much about her. We learn more about the other two girls.
But then again, with so much of that stuff, you could argue that that's the point. She doesn't really get her own agency. She's just trampled on by everyone else.
Yeah, it's that tricky thing, isn't it, between give her a voice and, but I'm showing that she had no voice. Yeah. Something I do find interesting is that both the New York Times and the New Yorker comment on how her poetic prose could be distracting. And that's another thing we both love. You know, that's something that contemporary authors and poets like Max Porter and Ocean Vuong are so commended for now in their novels. Do you think it just wasn't in vogue then? And if that's the case, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I actually think so. I think it just shows how much she was ahead of her time. And I find those reviews incredibly snooty and sort of stuffy old critics in suits and ties who weren't prepared to read something inventive. Although I guess they're nowhere near as savage as the ones of Wuthering Heights when that came out.
There's nothing more withering than Wuthering.
None of them are written by her own sister. A more contemporary to us review I found interesting was from Oprah Winfrey, and I think it's interesting in itself because it's from Oprah, and that signifies this book's enduring significance in America. Toni Morrison's one of the biggest, most important figures in modern literature, but I think we don't fully appreciate her impact over here because she's so, so vital to them over there. Oprah says it's impossible to actually imagine the American literary landscape without Toni Morrison. She is our conscience, she is our seer, she is our truth teller. I love that. And the American scholar Valerie Babb says in The Guardian, she reshaped our literature, making it more reflective of the nation that generated it.
Which is why it should be on more frickin' English syllabuses. Kirkus Review, I saw, called it a quiet chronicle of garrotted innocence, which is also very well put.
That could be a line in the book, actually. I think it's on a lot of syllabuses in America. I think they study it loads over there, but it might be studied over here, but neither of us have studied it. I haven't seen it on any syllabuses.
I was thinking about how it had aged, and I do think if it was written now, there would be a lot of furore about the rape scene. I think there would be a lot of op-eds about it. And the thing is it's so vital because it's the only thing I've read where the writer doesn't so much defend or apologise for this crime. She does absolutely neither. But she lays out really sequentially the interconnecting thoughts that lead a man depraved and drunk to commit such an appalling crime. She takes you very slowly and carefully from A to B. And it's horrifying, but it also felt so refreshing because you don't see it in literature. Either it's alluded to or it's apologised for, and she does neither. And she really lays bare how this was seen as the victim's fault. The adults say Pecola carries some of the blame and how come she didn't fight him. And it reminded me that at the very tip of the iceberg, and obviously nothing to do with racism, is Laura Danker in Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, sending the boys crazy with her well-developed chest. She's blamed for things that she had no control over. Anyway, that scene with Pecola is brave and it's necessary, but I just don't think it would get written now. I just think writers would be really scared to write it. And I also really understand instantly why that would be so hard for so many people to read.
What I do find interesting is how it's aged in terms of the age of the readership, because as it's about young girls and what they're going through, it often falls under the YA young adult category. You go on the UK Guardian review on their website, it's listed under children's books. This might be totally wrong, and do feel free to prove me wrong with an email at bookchatpod@gmail.com. But I feel like you don't get young adult books like this now. I mean, you do in the fact that you get a brilliant amount of racially diverse young adult books and books about race. And Toni Morrison very much paved the way for that. But in terms of that graphic sexual content, it feels like it would be deemed way too adult for kids to read now.
I know. At first I was like, what? How is this a kid's book? But then I thought about the fact that I read Jilly Cooper, age 10. You know, why on earth should I read that and not this? Or George Orwell's Animal Farm, which I read age 12 and went entirely over my head. Or Lord of the Flies. Kel Surprise, all white authors I'm listing here. I don't think that 10, 11 or 12 is too young to learn about rape and racism. I still think that scene, I think there'll be a lot of column inches on it.
I think it's really interesting looking at the context of this book, which naturally is the exact same context of Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, because while the latter book, the Judy Blume book, feels like something that could have been written today, or at least in the 80s or 90s, it feels like that's maybe because that version of America, the white version of America, suburbia is safe. Things don't really change. Something that absolutely blew my mind is that there are only 6 years between Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, and the end of segregation in 1964. Toni Morrison actually started writing The Bluest Eye before the Civil Rights Act was passed. So when you read this book, you have to put it in this context of just what a brutal existence it was being black in America.
Very good context. Thank you for that. Would you have changed anything?
I think it's kind of a moot point. It'd be like changing Shakespeare to give Romeo and Juliet a happy ending. I think I think when something is so influential and already so entrenched in the collective imagination, you can usually say this is probably exactly as it should be.
Well, Toni Morrison pointed out something that could be changed. Pekka's rape being narrated by Cholly, as we said earlier, so it's seen through the male gaze. But she wrote afterwards that she does not handle effectively the silence at its centre, the voice that is Pekka's unbeing. It should have had a shape like the emptiness left by a boom or a cry. God, again, like, what a sentence. The voice, the shape of her unbeing. I found it really powerful to know what went through Cholly's mind. I don't think you read that much, but I understand how to read her into the author herself. That felt like the wrong call. As we spoke earlier, it's that kind of wrangle between they are voiceless, should they have a voice, or should you show that they are voiceless by them not having a voice?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the part of this book that would not fly if it was written now, is to not only have the rape from the rapist's point of view, but to kind of, in that context, justify the reasons behind it and give him sympathy. It did kind of leave it. I get it, but it did leave a bad taste in the mouth. And it's so interesting to hear Toni Morrison herself confront that head on. I think that's really, really admirable to do that with your own book.
So you saw that as her justifying or sympathizing. That's so interesting. I saw it as like completely undecorative.
I kind of did, because I think there's a chapter where you are very much made to feel sympathetic for Cholly. And I think that these are two parts of the same book. So I found that, you know, you couldn't really separate those two versions of Cholly. And for that reason, I think that's why it left a bad taste.
I wish I'd had more time to read all of the essays that I know would have been written on this subject, to read how people have felt about it for the last 53 years, because I'm sure there would be such an interesting journey with that. I won't ask you if it's classic Toni Morrison, because you've already outed yourself as a newbie. And obviously I've only read Beloved and a very long time ago, so I wouldn't be able to say it either. What I will ask is, will you be reading more of her?
100%, absolutely, definitely. And there's one review I didn't mention earlier, which I totally agree with, which was from the Washington Post, and said, discovering a writer like Toni Morrison is the rarest of pleasures. That is exactly how I feel. I felt when I was reading this a bit like when I first read Mohsin Hamid, and I had that really nice feeling of, oh my God, this is great. And this person has also written loads of other books that I now get to read. It is like the best feeling.
That's how I felt about Armistead Maupin. But yes, agree. I absolutely renewedly felt that reading this. I really want to read Tar Baby and Paradise next. I have lots of catching up to do.
Thank you for listening. As ever, it means a lot to both of us, and we absolutely love it when you email us your thoughts, so please do get in touch at bookchatpod@gmail.com.
Our books for the next episode are Stoner by John Williams and The Unbearable Lightness of Being by Milan Kundera.
Book Chat is hosted by Pandora Sykes and Bobby Palmer, with sound by Joel Grove and production by Pandora Sykes.
See you on the flip!
Woohoo!